A popular sketch character from Saturday Night Live makes the jump from the small screen to the big screen.
But should it have? Coming up next on Out of Touchdown. Ah, the dulcet tones of the legendary Gladys Knight and her Pips as well. That was a song called The Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me. And I can tell you right now that the best thing that ever happened to us was the ending of the movie we're about to discuss right now. This is Out of Touchstone, and my name is Mike DeKalb. On the other end of the Skype line is my co-host, Chad Smart. Chad, I don't like to necessarily have titles for the episodes ahead of time. I like to just get them organically. But this one I'm going to call The August of Doom. Because in 1994, Touchstone released a movie and Hollywood Pictures released three movies. And they were not the greatest. And unfortunately, the Touchstone movie we're about to discuss is one of the worst. Are you ready to soldier on?
I am. I was kind of surprised when I saw your rundown that you were putting the Gladys Knight song in there. Because I figured you would have put in a different band based on the movie itself. But...
I'm not a huge fan of Ween. I think is that what you're going for?
That's what I'm going for. Yes.
Oh my god. We've got four movies to discuss, so I don't want to waste any time. But on the other hand, hopefully we can just get through these because this is, I'll just tell you real quick. When we first planned this podcast, I built up a spreadsheet with all of the Touchstone movies, and I kind of planned them all out. How are we going to do the episodes? And I'll be honest, I was dreading this one. I mean, I saw it on the schedule, 10 years into Touchstone's run, and I just said, I'm not looking forward to this one.
But I was going to ask you real quick, this movie is based on a Saturday Night Live character. How many of the Saturday Night Live movies have you really enjoyed?
Outside of Wayne's World. I've not seen a lot of the other ones, like Roxbury and Superstar and MacGruber. You and I saw MacGruber in the theater. It was fine, but yeah.
Yeah. According to my stats here, there are 11 Saturday Night Live movies. And I'm going to say MacGruber was probably one that I could watch again easily. But yeah. Everything else is. And I know you and I, our college connection with the Blues Brothers. I don't like the Blues Brothers. I think it's way too long and overrated.
And I've actually never seen it. Yeah. My wife and I were just at Universal Studios in Orlando, and they had the characters with the cop car driving around, and it's just like, I don't know it. But, according to my records, this was the fifth Saturday Night Live movie. For whatever reason, Touchstone decided to dip their hands into it and get involved with that Saturday Night Live franchise rather than the other studios that had dealt with those movies before. It was released on August 26th of 1994, which actually was my 18th birthday. And I can tell you what I wasn't doing on my 18th birthday, and that was going to the theater to see It's Pat, the movie.
It's a word for what you are.
Charismatic?
This summer, if you think it's a man...
Pat, I'm in a towel. Should I be embarrassed?
Ouch!
If you're positive it's a woman...
Oh, Something we'll both enjoy.
Then there's one thing for sure.
What's Pat's laundry like?
It was, bras, panties, boxer shorts, jock straps.
It's Pat, the movie.
Whoa, Pat. Is that a banana in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
No, it's a banana.
As we mentioned, this was based on a Saturday Night Live sketch that debuted in 1990. The character appeared several times in the show, but was retired at the end of the 1993-1994 season. Ironically enough, Pat did not appear during that season at all. There was just a moment at the end of the season. I think it was the final episode, and Julia Sweeney was dressed as Pat, waving to the audience, and that was the last time you saw it. Yeah. As I mentioned, the character of Pat was created by Julia Sweeney while she was a member of the Groundlings comedy troupe in the late 1980s. Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live came to see a performance of the Groundlings, and at the time, Julia Sweeney showcased that character, and she claimed it helped her get the job on SNL. Yeah. She had appeared on Saturday Night Live for four seasons, from 1990 to 1994. During her final season on Saturday Night Live, she developed the screenplay for It's Pat, the movie. At that point, her only previous writing credits were an episode of a TV show called On the Television in 1989. I read that this was kind of a spoof of TV shows that was created by a fellow Groundlings alum by the name of George McGrath. And the other writing credit she had was the 1986 Elvira's Halloween special, which was co-written by George McGrath and Elvira herself, which I forgot, Chad. Elvira was in the Groundlings as well. Cassandra Peterson is in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, right? Pee-wee was a groundling, right?
Do you remember the Elvira Halloween special?
I do not. I'm a huge Elvira fan, but I do not remember that. So that's not Paul Lynn. I'm thinking of something else.
Yeah, I don't either. I was just wondering if you did, you could refresh my memory, but I got nothing for it.
Okay. Well, Julia Sweeney actually co-wrote It's Pat with two other writers who got credits. They were Jim Emerson and Stephen Hibbert. Now, Hibbert was in the Groundlings and was married to Julia Sweeney at the time. And Jim Emerson was Sweeney's longtime friend who helped her create the Pat character. Jim Emerson's only writing credits to this day are two 1994 episodes of Saturday Night Live. Neither one of them had a Pat sketch in it. Randy random. He spent most of his career as a film critic and actually ran Roger Ebert's website for a time. Hibbert's prior writing credits before this included, there's that TV show again, On the Television, but mostly animated stuff like Darkwing Duck, Tiny Toon Adventures, and Animaniacs. Oh, those are some good ones right there. The film was directed by Adam Bernstein, who worked almost exclusively in music videos. He'd done a lot of stuff for They Might Be Giants. He did both Love Shack and Rome for the B-52s. A lot of hip-hop, EPMD, Public Enemy. He did the Beastie Boys video for Hey Ladies, which I love. But he's most known for doing Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby Got Back. A video, Chad, if you remember, when it first premiered, it had to be on after, I think it was like midnight Eastern when it first debuted. I didn't see it until later that evening when it first came out. Yeah. And then he'd also directed one episode of Nickelodeon's kind of cult favorite show called The Adventures of Pete and Pete. Do you remember that show? Did you ever see it?
I know of the show, but I never watched it. It was after my time of watching Nickelodeon.
Okay. Well, just like the writers on this film, the cast was mostly filled with a lot of sketch comedy veterans. As we mentioned, you know, Julia Sweeney, she reprises her role as the character of Pat. Her only acting credits outside of Saturday Night Live were bit parts in films like Gremlins 2, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid for Disney, and the previous Saturday Night Live film, which was Coneheads. Pat's love interest, Chris, was portrayed on Saturday Night Live by Dana Carvey, who wisely passed up on the film. The part went to Dave Foley, no stranger to sketch comedy himself. He was one of the creators of Kids in the Hall in 1988. Outside of that show, he'd done some small television work. He starred in a Canadian indie film called High Stakes. His other film appearance, I don't know if you remember this or not, Chad, but he played a grocery store clerk in the 1987 Touchstone film, Three Men and a Baby.
Well, yeah. I mean, he steals that scene. I think if you go back and listen to that episode where we talk about that, talk about Three Men and a Baby, we're like, man, Dave Foley, that's who the film should have been based around.
Yeah. And it's like that guy should start a sketch comedy show with a bunch of fellow Canadians, maybe. Yeah. The only other cast member I would like to call out would be Charles Rocket, who played the character of Kyle. He was on Saturday Night Live for one season from 1980 to 1981. I totally forgot he was the Weekend Update anchor as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this, but it's a little bit of Charles Rocket trivia.
Yeah, he was fired shortly after he cursed live on the air. But it didn't deter his career too bad. He followed it up with more TV work with shows like Remington Steele, Hardcastle and McCormick, Miami Vice, Max Headroom. Chad, do you remember he played the brother of Bruce Willis's character on Moonlighting?
I have never seen Moonlighting.
Oh, wonderful show.
I'll wait when it comes on to streaming in a few years.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that might take a while. His film work had actually included movies like Earth Girls Are Easy, How I Got Into College. He was in Dances with Wolves, and I was totally surprised by that. He's also in a movie that I may have talked about on this show before because I love it. It's the movie with John Candy called Delirious. Oh, so good. Most recently, Charles Rocket was in two films in 1993, the Robert Altman ensemble film Shortcuts and the Disney film Hocus Pocus. I forgot he plays the parents of the male, the boy lead, right, I think?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, okay. As far as the supporting cast, we have Kathy Griffin. Interestingly enough, Kathy Griffin plays a character in this movie named Kathy Griffin. And I don't know if the whole point is she's supposed to be playing herself, because at this point she had mostly done stand-up. She had done an episode of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and she was also on that show on the television. Yeah. We get Kathy and Jimmy, who comes back to Disney after doing Hocus Pocus and the Sister Act films. We get a couple of members of the Groundlings, Mary Shear and Phil LaMarr, who were both on Mad TV later. And then we get Tim Meadows. I feel like there was a time where Tim Meadows was in every Saturday Night Live movie. Before this, he had also been in Coneheads and Wayne's World 2. Chad, did you catch, there's a scene at a concert, and one of the security guards is played by Mitch Pileggi. And I was thinking, like, okay, maybe was this like he was just sort of coming up? No, he had already starred in Shocker. He had been in a bunch of stuff. I think he had just started doing X-Files. But it was just, I saw it when I was watching. I'm like, wait a minute, is that Skinner from X-Files as a security guard? Like, he was a bigger act. I don't know why he was doing these bit parts. And an interesting little trivia tidbit, Julia Sweeney's father plays the priest that marries Pat and Chris at the end of the movie. Spoiler alert, sorry. I don't think anybody's going to watch this unless you're really devoted to the show and you want to hear what we have to talk about.
Mike, I have one question for you, though. Going through the technical aspect or the cast and crew, there was one name that I was surprised that was not attached to this film.
Okay.
Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting, right?
And I figured being a Saturday Night Live film, he would have produced it. But when I pulled it up on Hoopla, which is where I streamed it, not a sponsor, mm-hmm. but we'll plug them again at the end of the show. You know, when the poster came up for It's Pat, it struck me as odd. And then when the credits started rolling and I didn't see his name, I'm like, okay, it all makes sense now. Because if you go and look at the majority of every movie that Lorne Michaels has produced, the poster is always the characters in front of a cloudy blue sky.
Oh, okay.
So It's Pat is just in front of a giant question mark. And I mean, which should detour anybody from watching it, because you're just like, what? But no. Yeah, Lorne Michaels did not produce this.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder how it got made, you know, without his blessing.
Oh, okay. We're going to get into our conversations about, we don't, like I said, we're not film critics. We don't necessarily do reviews, but I always like to pose questions to Chad. For the purposes of this conversation, because the whole Pat, the idea of the Pat characters, you don't know if Pat is a male or a female. I mean, we can use the pronouns they and them if it comes up, or we can just say the name Pat over and over again, like they do in the movie to avoid confusion. My first question to you, Chad, about It's Pat the movie. Why?
Yes. My first note that I took down to ask you was, how do you repeat one joke for 80 minutes?
Yeah, that's basically what it was. And it's a very broad one joke sketch extended into 77 minutes. I was counting. And it also includes a very long opening and closing credit sequence to pad out that runtime. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I went back and watched one sketch from Saturday Night Live. And even at like 4 or 5 minutes, that joke wears thin.
Mm-hmm.
But for an entire film, because there is no substance to this film other than what's Pat.
Yeah, the film plays like a one joke premise. I mean, it's just nothing but non sequiturs and what I call empty calorie jokes. You know, the whole point of, like, if you're doing stand up comedy or something, it's set up punchline. Okay, that makes sense. If you're doing a sketch, especially the It's Pat sketches, it's usually very quick. You know, they say something that's ambiguous. And then the characters around Pat go, oh, is Pat going to reveal if Pat is male or female? And then Pat says an answer that doesn't empty up the confusion at all. And so what makes it worse is, if you try to make a movie out of it, there's absolutely no structure. There's not really much of a plot. It's just a collection of scenes. And I think I joked with you when we were talking off the air that I don't know if I would even qualify this as a movie. It doesn't feel like I would even use that term. Like, it doesn't follow a three-act structure. There's no kind of character development, which, I mean, I guess I don't want to be too harsh. We're looking too deep into a movie based on a Saturday Night Live sketch, but at least Wayne Campbell had depth, you know? I just do not get it.
Yeah. I'm with you. I don't understand who thought this was a good idea to make it into a film. And then I guess, you know, you could say that this movie wasn't released so much as it escaped.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, and I feel like, in a way, like, a lot of the setup for the character or just the scenario in the whole movie is just based on, this has got to pay off with a quick joke. And I think this whole movie can be summed up with one, there's one scene in particular. And it is Pat and Chris are in their apartment. Pat lives on the second floor. And her next door neighbor, they've just moved in. This is Charles Rocket and his wife. And Pat tumbles down the stairs, just out of nowhere, just tumbles down the stairs. And when Pat comes to, everyone rushes to Pat and they say, "Oh my God, are you okay?" And Pat says, "I crushed my nuts." And it was, and then it becomes, what? And then Pat reveals that they had walnuts in their pocket.
Are you all right? Are you there?
Yeah, hon. Did you break anything?
Oh, I crushed my nuts!
Ooh, that's gonna hurt.
Oh, shoot! There goes my afternoon snack!
I know.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Kyle Jacobs, and this is my beautiful wife, Stacy.
Hi.
We just moved into apartment 2F.
I'm Chris. Hi. And this is Pat. Pat lives across the way from you in 2B.
2B or not 2B, that is my apartment. Oh, well, come on, let's go.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Strange couple.
You know, you can't really tell. It's peculiar.
Yes, yeah, peculiar, yet wondrously provocative.
Hi, y'all. Hi. Save that filth for the bedroom.
Ha 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 ha. I mean, it could be, that's something that would pay off in a 4-minute sketch on Saturday Night Live, but it's just, it's really weird. Like, is this an art piece? Is this a sort of high concept thing that I just, that went over our heads, Chad?
If it is, then I want to see the people who got it. Because yeah. I was trying to think back to when the Saturday Night Live sketches were on and how I felt about them. I don't think I ever watched an episode of Saturday Night Live going like, "Oh, please let there be a Pat sketch. Please let there be a Pat sketch." Mm-hmm. But I don't. And, you know, 30 years later, I don't get this movie. I don't even have words.
Well, and what made it really bizarre to me is, like, if you're going to try to develop this character from a sketch character into a feature film character, we you don't really get a sense of the personality because it's just a sketch character. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this feature, like, I was really surprised that they made Pat so rude and unlikable. You know, this is supposed to be the protagonist of your film, and it just, Pat is completely obnoxious. Yeah. You know, at the beginning of the movie, Pat is introduced as, like, having this dream job as, like, a mail carrier. And then you see Pat going through people's mail and then getting fired and wondering, like, "Oh my God, why did I get fired?" Or like Pat's always walking into people's houses or looking through the windows. And Pat is completely, like, unaware. And it makes it hard to sort of watch a film with such an unappealing main character.
I agree with you. And, you know, I can only think about the, I don't know if you've watched the Diary of a Wimpy Kid films, but that main character is also, like, you watch him, he's like, he's not a good kid. You know, he's the, mm-hmm. he's the annoying one, like, that gets his friend into trouble most of the time. And that is Pat. That is, like you said, there's nothing redeemable about Pat. And it's not mm-hmm. like Pat is an anti-hero that you aren't supposed to like, but do because they're so cool or badass. It's just annoying. And I think that makes watching the movie even harder because you just don't, you know, there's nothing on screen that is appealing.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny you mentioned, I didn't mind the Diary of a Wimpy Kid movies. I saw a couple of the early ones. I have not seen the new reboot. But I can hear what you're saying about that main character not being the most appealing. The one I used to always pick on, I don't want to jump on Disney, but I always surprised with Lizzie McGuire. Because I watched Lizzie McGuire with my nieces, and that character's not, she's very judgmental. She doesn't really have a lot of friends. She just has like two core friends and then doesn't get along with anybody else at the school, it seems like. And I'm always surprised. I'm like, this is the main character that you want people to kind of look up to. Yeah. Well, the one character that I did look up to in this movie, just because I was like, what is he thinking and what are his motivations, was the character of Kyle, played by Charles Rocket. And I was going to ask you, can you explain this character? Because to me, it was one of the most bizarre movie characters I've ever seen. Like, Charles Rocket has a very dry, absurdist humor. So it definitely fits this movie, but his entire persona just seemed to be the result of making a feature-length film out of a one-joke sketch. Like, all he wants to do is figure out if Pat is male or female. And so he just keeps hanging around and trying to delve deeper and deeper into Pat's personality, and it makes no sense whatsoever because he's ignoring his wife. And I'm like, it seems like this, like I said, it's like kind of an absurdist joke. Yeah. That is another one of the ones. It's kind of just over my head.
I would say that's, you know, comparable to Cabin Boy in that regard, where it's probably the only part of the movie that I did find somewhat, I don't want to say entertaining, but maybe a little interesting, because his character takes it like a 180 turn from sensible guy into just creepy stalker, Bridget Fonda, single white female type character, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, oh, yeah.
And I think there's something there. I don't think they fully developed that storyline, and I don't think it had a payoff that I recall. But that's the one part of the film that I could say, like, at least that was there and did something. But
I mean, yes. But he makes yeah. it. I will give Charles Rocket credit, because if it was anybody else, this movie would be even worse, if that was possible. Like, I don't even know how they would have pulled that off. Again, nothing, none of the jokes. The last question I had for you was, did any of the jokes work? Because I got one little bit of a smile and a chuckle out of, there's a scene where Pat gets a makeover. And so the beautician doesn't know to like make Pat over as a man or as a woman. And then at the end, it's just like almost the exact same thing that Pat walked in with. And says, oh my God, it's perfect. So that was like, okay, you know, I understand comedy is subjective, but I nothing worked. Yeah. It did any for you?
Yeah, you know, thinking about it now, I mean, there's no joke really or scene other than maybe the scene when she goes into the drugstore and is talking to Kathy and Jimmy about the products that are needed, you know, to purchase. But I can't recall any joke from this film. You know, but then again, it's only one joke. So if I remember something, it's the exact same joke that came before and after it. So
Good call on Kathy and Jimmy. I forgot about that. Yeah. Kathy and Jimmy was kind of clever in that one scene. And so when it comes to the jokes I'll remember, I honestly crushed my nuts, man. That's pretty much what it is.
Oh, I crushed my nuts.
I will say that I was talking to someone that used to work at Disney for years back in the feature restoration team. And when I told him that we had watched It's Pat for the podcast, he said, I only have one thing to say about that movie. It's only four reels long. And that's all. I think I had that in my notes. At least this movie was short. Now, I'm hoping that we're not alone in our criticism of this movie. Chad, what were the other prominent critics of the era have to say about It's Pat? Did they also champion the length of the film?
I just like how you say prominent critics. Like, I could find any respectable critic that reviewed this film when it came out.
Oh, well, okay.
I do have two reviews. Neither one is anybody that I may have used one of them before on a previous episode, but the first one comes from Joe Layden from Variety, who says, Julia Sweeney has almost perversely turned the relatively harmless TV character into a boorish, egotistical creep for the big screen. Fans of the SNL sketches will be disappointed. Non-fans won't bother. Now, to balance that, Kevin Thomas of the LA Times says, It's Pat offers a simple message of self-acceptance, asserting that what counts is who you are rather than what your gender may or may not be. The trouble is that its telling is truly terrible. Those are the prominent critics that I could find.
Ebert didn't bother to watch this?
I could not find a Roger Ebert review, and I'm very lucky. Disappointed.
Because, lucky, lucky man. Well, we weren't lucky. Chad, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate this film?
You know, I have to go a 1, just because there's nothing, I don't see myself ever coming back to this film. You know, I have tried to get people to watch Cats. I get people to watch The Apple, which I know are not good films, but are enjoyable to me. Yeah. I wouldn't even mockingly suggest someone watch It's Pat.
Yeah, I love Hudson Hawk. You know, we all have a movie like that, that a lot of people kind of panned and that we like. This one, yeah, I don't, because I don't want to give a 0 out of 10, then I'm forced to give a 1. Yeah, it's a complete waste of time. There's nothing redeeming about it at all. And the disappointing part for me was that we had set the bar so low and it still couldn't be met. Because you watched the movie first, and when I told you I was going to watch it, you said, you know, it's going to be awful, and you know, and I was like, okay, that's great. I'm sure there'll be something out of it. And within, I think you asked me, how soon did you check out? And I think it was about 6 minutes into the movie that it was like, okay, there's nothing here to be discussed. And it's, I'm like, we can hopefully get on with the rest of the episode then, basically. From a trivia standpoint, I did see that Quentin Tarantino did an uncredited rewrite of the script. I believe he and Julia Sweeney were friends. I mean, what would have happened had he gotten his hands into it? Would there have been a lot more violence? Who knows? I mean, maybe it might have been more entertaining. I did see that Julia Sweeney, as well as Kathy Griffin and Phil LaMarr from this film, were all in Pulp Fiction in 1994 as well. You mentioned before about Lorne Michaels not serving as a producer in this film. I did see that the movie was originally set up at 20th Century Fox before the rights moved to Touchstone. I didn't see any, couldn't find any more details about how it got over there. Did they just give it up? Did it go into turnaround? I was reading an interview with Julia Sweeney from 1993 where she talked about, you know, the script was going and the Fox people were calling her for updates. And yeah. From a personal connection standpoint, I could not find anybody in this movie that you and I had ever seen in person. Unless I'm forgetting somebody. There was no Q&As or anything like that.
And I think after watching this movie, I don't think we'll be looking for anybody that was in this film because we would not want to bring this film up to them.
I feel bad because like, if you ever got a chance to meet Julia Sweeney, I would love to just talk to her about the process of making this movie and without trying to be too critical about the actual end product, but just to know what went into doing it and what kind of how positive executives were when she was delivering the script and all that stuff. Yeah. The legacy of the film, well, yeah, this isn't going to be touched again. This isn't going to be remade, nothing like that. I would say that it was the nail in the coffin of that character. I was reading on IMDb that Julia Sweeney only appeared as Pat one more time. She was live in person in West Hollywood on Halloween of 1994. You know, I feel like you mentioned, prior Saturday Night Live films like Blues Brothers and Wayne's World had been hits, but I think at this point it was an oversaturation. I saw that there were 4 SNL films in 2.5 years, and Stuart Saves His Family was coming out the following spring. After Stuart Saves His Family, the next Saturday Night Live film wasn't until 1998. So at the end of the day, the legacy of this movie, I really do believe it is the most notorious film in the Touchstone catalog. You know, we talked last episode about I Love Trouble, and I still think it's Touchstone's Ishtar because of the star power that it had. But at least it had a plot and it had good production values and stuff. It's weird to think about the legacy of this movie was what that man told me earlier, 4 reels, right?
Well, I just want to end with a quote that I pulled from Julia Sweeney, and I don't have a year. I think this is a kind of recent quote. And she says, "As an artist, I don't want to never hurt anyone's feelings. I didn't do that character to make anyone feel bad. On the other hand, I created a character and then people happen to look like that character. I'm not responsible if they take it negatively either. So it's a complicated situation." And I think that's where Pat lies in today's, you know, society, because I don't think it's a Saturday Night Live character that is held up. You know, if you made a list of top 25 SNL characters, Pat is probably not going to make the list. And I think we probably would have been better served with a Matt Foley movie instead of Pat.
Oh, don't even speak that into existence. That would have been much more wonderful. Yeah, I got nothing else to say about this movie. We're done.
Let's take our next call. Hello.
Hi, Pat.
Hello, don't waste my time. What's your name, caller?
Well, it's... you can call me Chris, Pat.
All right, Chris, what's your problem?
Well, I had this special someone in my life. We'll call this person Pat. And, well, we were engaged, yeah. And, well, I just didn't feel that Pat was ready to make a commitment, not to a job or to me. But now, for the first time, Pat has some job stability and... Yeah, I just want to tell Pat that I love Pat for who Pat is and not for what Pat does. And I really wish we could get back together again, Pat.
Well, you're not giving me much to go on here, Chris. Can you be more specific?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at, Pat, is that, well, I'm leaving for Tibet tomorrow, you know, to get over Pat, and I'm not so sure that's the right thing to do now, Pat.
Well, if you're asking for my advice, and I guess you are, I would say that this Pat person just sounds like a real nightmare. I say hit the road and don't look back. Next call. Some people, I don't know why they get hooked up with these losers in the first place.
Well, as we mentioned, Disney released three other films in August of 1994, all under the Hollywood Pictures label. The first one came out on August 12th, and it's called In the Army Now.
He was looking for a little change in his life.
Just a little bit on the side.
He found it in the army. Now he's pushing himself to the limit.
All the way up and down, right?
And living each day to the fullest. Because the future of America...
Drop the pin, throw the grenade.
...is in his hands.
Idiot proof.
Ollie Shore.
Stuck on this the one time.
In the Army Now.
It looks like our truck.
Rated PG. Starts Friday, August 12th at a theater near you.
Chad, this film had eight writers. Eight. I was surprised to see, you know, usually you'll see a handful of people get a story credit, and then some of the people that get the story credit also get a screenplay credit. Oh, no. Three people with a story credit, five separate people with a screenplay credit, which makes me think this must have sat on a shelf. It was a pitch. And then they just kept having people tackle different iterations of it until they got their star, I guess. The story credits go to Steve Zacharias and Jeff Buhai. They're responsible for the Revenge of the Nerds franchise. Also, they had done Johnny B. Goode and another writer named Robbie Fox. He had just done So I Married an Axe Murderer in 1993. The screenplay credits, those go to Fax Barr and Adam Small. They had written In Living Color and Son-in-Law. We have Ken Kaufman, who's making his writing debut. Stu Krieger, who had done The Land Before Time and A Troll in Central Park for Don Bluth. And lastly, Daniel Petrie Jr. He also directed this film. His credits include Beverly Hills Cop, The Big Easy. He wrote two Touchstone films, Shoot to Kill and Turner and Hooch. And he also wrote and directed a movie that Chad and I both really enjoyed, Toy Soldiers, with our friend Keith Coogan. The plot's pretty simple. It's two dumb guys, Pauly Shore and Andy Dick, and they join the army and get called into action. Hilarity ensues. Some of the fellow recruits are played by some talented actors such as Lori Petty and David Alan Grier. We also get a very bit part. I don't know if you, I think I had to tell you this after the fact, but Keith Coogan from Adventures in Babysitting is at the very end of the movie playing like a stoner. He's got a long wig. You can hardly tell it's him. And we also get a really good turn from Art LaFleur, who had been in the Touchstone film Oscar. I believe he played Babe Ruth, I want to say, in The Sandlot. He plays Pauly Shore's commanding officer. He's really good. Chad, did you see In the Army Now in the theaters?
Oh, yes, I did. I enlisted for that tour of duty for 90 minutes. And before I rewatched it, I had not seen it in, you know, 29 years. I couldn't tell you anything about the movie other than the premise of Pauly Shore joins the army. And now, yeah, after watching the movie, I can tell you about two other things about the movie.
Yeah. That Andy Dick and Lori Petty were in it, and Keith Coogan has a cameo. Yeah. Like, it's, I mean, it's a mostly harmless comedy, and I guess it really all depends on how much you like Pauly Shore. I never want to get too far into comparing and contrasting. It's no Son-in-Law. We both love Son-in-Law. Son-in-Law is awesome. I don't know why that one stands up so much better than his other movies, but this was just, it was kind of dumb. It's not entirely enjoyable. I mean, it has its moments. It does stall out once they get called into action. You know, the boot camp scenes are the most effective, which I think is pretty common in a lot of military films. I really liked the instructor in the boot camp was Lynn Whitfield, who's really good as well. But this was something that was like, again, we started this podcast, and especially we started to expand to watching the Hollywood films. I was like, oh, let's get a chance to check out some of these movies I remember being around. And yes, I remember trailers for this. I remember seeing the box at the video store. And yeah, I mean, I'm glad I saw it. It was fine. But there's really not a whole lot to speak about.
No, and I'll throw this question to you. Do you think it's because Pauly Shore wasn't playing 100% the Pauly, the weasel character? he was more toned down and maybe a little bit too normal for this film.
That's a good point. I mean, because like he has a job at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't. You could tell that he's kind of a putz, and he ends up getting fired from it fairly easily. But yeah, you're right. He wasn't in full weasel mode, and that's the reason everyone seems to love Encino Man and Son-in-Law, mm-hmm. right? Good call. Well, moving on, the next Hollywood picture came out the following week, which kind of gives you an idea of what they thought of In the Army Now. That was released on August 19th, and it's the erotic thriller Color of Night.
You're the fantasy girl, aren't you?
There's a fine line.
It's exactly what I am.
Between desire.
Charming chameleon with a scorpion's tail.
And deception.
One of my patients was killed last night. How did you get in here?
And if he crosses it.
You've fallen into a trap.
There's no turning back.
People are getting killed around here.
Bruce Willis.
I think I might be next.
Color of Night. Rated R. Starts Friday, August 19th.
The story and screenplay credit for this film goes to Billy Ray. It was his writing debut. Interestingly enough, he was college roommates with Robbie Fox, who got the story credit for In the Army Now. There was a co-writer on this film as well. His name is Matthew Chapman. He had just done Consenting Adults for Hollywood Pictures in 1992. This was directed by Richard Rush. I don't know if you know that name, Chad. Very enigmatic filmmaker, known for a lot of B-movies in the 60s and also for a fascinating movie called The Stuntman.
I have seen The Stuntman, but I am hard-pressed to tell you anything about that one either.
You have seen that movie?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Just the last 2-3 years.
Okay. I was gonna ask you because I was going to say if you hadn't, you need to see it. It's one of those ones that it may not be highly acclaimed, mm-hmm. but it's so fascinating that I would recommend it to anybody. We watched it when I was in film school. I took a class that was movies about Hollywood. And this was one of the ones they threw on there. I feel like no one had seen it. And we all walked out like, it's just different. It's about a stuntman who stumbles on, he's like escaped running from the law, and he stumbles onto a movie set and he gets hired as the stuntman. And there's just so much stuff where you don't know what's real and what's not. And it was basically like Richard Rush's tale that was sort of trying to do a diatribe against Hollywood itself. And then it's fascinating. This movie, Color of Night, not so much. The plot, Bruce Willis plays a psychologist from New York who comes to Los Angeles to visit a friend of his, played by Scott Bakula, who's also a therapist, and he has his own therapy group. Now, that friend gets murdered, and so Bruce Willis takes over the therapy group. In the meantime, he falls for a mysterious woman, played by Jane March, and he gets dragged into the murder mystery as his therapy patients start getting murdered one by one. The therapy group includes some very talented actors, such as Leslie Ann Warren, Brad Dourif, and Lance Henriksen. We got a few personnel connections, I'd like to say, when it comes to people coming back from Disney and Touchstone films. We get Ruben Blades, who was in a couple of Touchstone movies, Disorganized Crime and Life with Mikey. And we also get Andrew Lowry, who didn't do a whole lot of acting, but he was the lead in My Boyfriend's Back, a movie that I really enjoyed. And he gets a pretty prominent role in this film. It seemed like it was a little pocket of his career right there, where he was two big Disney movies and then not much else after that. My thoughts on this film is just, this movie is ridiculous. You know, I really don't know if we need Bruce Willis in an erotic thriller. You know, it's very predictable. It's over the top with cheesiness. And it just seems like perfect Razzie material. There was stuff that when I was watching this movie elicits a lot of unintentional laughter. Tell me I wasn't the only one, Chad.
You know, I had not seen this since watching it on video back in probably 1994, 95. And I enjoyed the film. But
really?
Again, I'm not going to say like, oh my gosh, this is a must-see film. But I did enjoy it. And I mean, there are elements that I think don't necessarily work. You know, they're a little too convenient. And I don't want to spoil anything. But I think there are some characters that aren't developed enough to really play into the connection that they have in the film. Mm-hmm. And I also don't think that if a therapist gets killed, your friend can just walk in and be like, cool, I'm taking over this group and go from there. But again, like you said, it's a great cast, kind of like Disorganized Crime, where great cast, the end product isn't as good as it could have been. But you know, maybe if this movie hadn't got made, would Bruce Willis have gotten the role in The Sixth Sense?
Who knows?
Because this shows him a different side of Bruce Willis.
Yeah, that's true. I just feel like some of all the moments that kind of the thriller moments from the film, they're just I was laughing. I wasn't sort of terrified or anything. You know, snake in a mailbox, a car driving off of a parking garage, and he dives out of the way. Oh. And then what makes it worse is, you know, I read that Richard Rush fought with the producer over the final cut, and it shows on screen. It's very choppy. There's about three or four different versions of this film out there. I was pleasantly surprised that this movie is also streaming on Hoopla Digital. And on, if you look on the interface, it says the movie's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And I was like, oh God. And then as soon as I pressed play, it said 2 hours and 1 minute. So at least we got the shorter theatrical cut is what's airing on Hoopla. If anybody wants to see it, it's almost like it's Pat. I'll dare you to watch it and see what you think of it.
Yeah. One more question. Given the time frame that this movie was made, would it have benefited the film, do you think, if they would have brought Joe Esterhaus in to do a touch-up or a rewrite of the script?
I wonder, because you're right. Does it give off a lot of Basic Instinct vibes, right? When he was the king of the erotic thriller at that time, wasn't he? Yeah, that's a good point. It's almost like I wonder sometimes, is it better to be laughable and over the top? Yeah. Because there's moments in Basic Instinct that kind of make you laugh unintentionally. But, oh my God. Well, at least there was one really good movie that came out of Disney in August. Like It's Pat, it was also released on August 26, 1994. And again, if I had known that this movie was out on my birthday, I might have tried to check it out, because some 30 years later, I wound up really enjoying it. And it was called Camp Nowhere.
They've left their parents miles behind.
It's deranged.
And created their own camp.
Brilliant.
Now, things are looking up.
You know, if you wore a skirt right now, I'd be in heaven.
Excitement's in the air.
Let's do this.
Wait a minute!
And the fun.
What kind of omelet is that? Popcorn.
Breakfast of champions. Is blowing the roof off the summer. Christopher Lloyd.
He's my role model.
Camp Nowhere.
It was written by Andrew Kurtzman and Elliot Wald. They had both written for Saturday Night Live in the early 1980s, and they also did the screenplay for See No Evil, Hear No Evil in 1989 with Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, right? Yeah, I remember seeing that movie back in the day. It was directed by Jonathan Prince. At that point, he'd only directed television shows like Dream On and Blossom. He was also a producer on that show as well. The plot is basically a group of kids are forced by their parents to attend various summer camps, and so they conspire to create a fictitious camp with no parental supervision. The counselor that they hire is played by Christopher Lloyd, who of course was coming off of Angels in the Outfield for Disney. He'd also done Roger Rabbit for Touchstone. The group of kids all seem to go on to greater success later in their careers. Not a lot of credits prior to this film. We get kids like Jonathan Jackson, Andrew Keegan's going to turn up in 10 Things I Hate About You, also started his own religion. Marnette Patterson, one of those faces. As soon as you see her, you know who that is. She wound up, I think, on Third Rock a little bit later. And then we also get, I believe it's one of the earliest roles, if not the film debut, of Jessica Alba. In addition to the kids, the adult cast is really great. You know, Wendy McKenna from the Sister Act films is in this. We get Peter Sklari. Peter Onorati, another great character actor. I forgot he was in the Touchstone film Firebirds. Oh, speaking of movies, we only gave one star to. We get Thomas Wilson, Biff Tannen. I forgot he was in Blood In, Blood Out for Hollywood Pictures. M. Emmett Walsh. Burgess Meredith has a cameo in this movie. And we go into the future, into the Star Trek franchise with Kate Mulgrew and Jonathan Frakes, along with his real-life wife, Jeannie Francis. Before I forget, Chad, I was going to point this out to you. I was fascinated to see that 1994's Camp Nowhere is the film debut of Jonathan Frakes and Jeannie Francis.
The film debut.
The film debut of both of those two. Yeah, Jeannie Francis had been in soap operas for years. Jonathan Frakes, of course, had been on Star Trek The Next Generation for several years.
Star Trek came out in the late 80s, so
Yeah, the very first Star Trek film that he was in was Star Trek Generations, which came out, I believe, later in the fall of 1994. So, yeah, film debut, Camp Nowhere. What did you think of Chad? I think you said you'd seen this a few years in the past, but I really enjoyed it. What did you think of it?
Again, this is a movie that is the reason why we do this podcast.
Absolutely.
Because this is not, you know, it's not Oscar material. It's just a fun film with a kind of outlandish premise that would never, you know, play off in reality, but it sucks you in. You're, like you said, the cast is near perfect casting for everybody.
Oh yeah.
And it just, it's a fun 90 minutes that you can sit back and be entertained.
Yeah, for sure. I thought it was a joy to watch. It's got a very clever premise. Mm-hmm. It's just something you could put on to pass the time. It's a good time waster, and you won't feel like disappointed that you did. Mm-hmm. It reminds me a lot of Blank Check, mm-hmm. that same sort of Disney, you know, plays to kids. This one actually would be more towards junior high schoolers, and we're going to get into that. I got a theory on this when we get into the box office. But yeah, and I really feel like even the third act of the film really pays off. There's some great comic scenarios and predicaments. They don't spend too much time. I think the only thing that's a little bit unbelievable is the love story between Wendy McKenna and Christopher Lloyd. You know, you want them to be happy and stuff, but it's a little weird because it's like the movie's supposed to be about the kids, and yet they do play up this love story between the adults. But it's fun. And I would like to say Disney, hopefully throughout the 1990s as we move along, I want to see more movies like this. And the only question I have for you is, why do you think Hollywood Pictures released this film and not Disney?
That is a good question, and I don't have an answer.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a deal with the writers or the producers, directors that they want the Hollywood brand, you know, as opposed to the Disney brand. I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird because I feel like a lot of the Hollywood pictures seem to be, you know, adult thrillers like Color of Night or Consenting Adults. Or they're just these goofy comedies with Pauly Shore in them. But yet, just to give you an idea of why I was surprised that this wasn't released by Disney themselves, is that the film is streaming on Disney Plus. Like, if it's good enough years later to be streaming on the sort of family-friendly platform,
maybe confused. I'm trying to think of, you know, Disney films that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. And if I had a better memory of the movies that we talked about on this show, I could easily do that. But I wonder if because this is geared more towards a preteen or teen audience, that maybe it was too edgy, and I'm air quoting edgy, for the Disney brand.
No, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah. Again, I mean, none of these films did particularly well at the box office, but I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that, like, who is it for? You know, that and so speaking of which, yeah, we'll just go into that, our box office discussion. As I like to do, we'll go in chronological order just to kind of keep things simple. As you mentioned, the first film that came out from this batch was In the Army Now, which was released on August 12th. Its opening weekend, it finished sixth place with $6.5 million. The other films that it opened against were The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is only on 7 screens. The first place at the box office was Clear and Present Danger. So that means we're still in the summer, right? So we're going to have those sort of action movies. The only Disney films that were also on the chart at the time was The Lion King, which was in 8th place, and Angels in the Outfield, which was in 10th place. And its second week In the Army Now drops to 9th, though there was only one new movie, which was The Color of Night. It's never a good sign when you drop from 6th to 9th and there's only one new movie. And then it drops to 12th and then 14th over the Labor Day weekend. It drops off the box office charts after 5 weeks. It only grosses $28.9 million in its entire theatrical run. I could not find any budget info. If you want to analyze that, you know, Chad, I think we mentioned it with Encino Man. Pauly Shore isn't necessarily a box office draw. You know, I think he got helped out by some of the holidays. I did see that Encino Man came out Memorial Day of 1992, and it made $40 million. Son-in-Law came out around July 4th of 1993 and made $36 million. So they were still keeping him in the summer, but maybe he didn't have that extra padding from the holiday weekend. He was still on MTV at the time with Totally Pauly, but I'm wondering if was his act really only for those TV viewers, perhaps? I mean, I don't know.
And like we said earlier, because he wasn't the weasel in the movie, maybe it just didn't appeal. Or I don't know if, maybe it could just be the premise too, because after Stripes and Full Metal Jacket, do you need another comedy army movie?
Well, that's true. Yeah. And then as far as what it was up against that summer at the box office, it was like there weren't really a lot of comedy films for teenagers or college students. You know, the other comedies that we had were movies like The Mask and It Could Happen to You, which presumably both might be for adults. And then you get movies like Little Rascals or Camp Nowhere, or Andre. Those are more for families. And then I think the only other one I saw was Blank Man, and that totally bombed. You know, I feel like Disney set this film up for success, but it just wasn't that good, maybe. And, you know, nearly $30 million might have been about as good as you could expect. And I do wonder if it had been a little bit better, maybe with some of the casting choices, it could have equaled the returns of Pauly's previous film.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look back at Encino Man and Sean Astin, obviously, you know, well known from his days as a Goonie, and Rudy, I think, had come out before Encino Man, maybe not. And Brendan Fraser was a new actor on the scene, so he wasn't selling the movie. But, you know, how big was Andy Dick at the time that this movie came out?
Yeah, not so much.
News Radio, I don't think, had started yet.
Yeah, but I also wonder about the talent, too, because, like, Son-in-Law, I mean, obviously, we love Lane Smith, but you look at, like, Carlo Gugino was so great in that, she probably wasn't overly known. I mean, we're both big Saved by the Bell fans, so it's good to see Kelly Kapowski on the big screen, Tiffany Amber Thiessen. But, yeah, I really feel like a couple of small minor choices here or there, maybe it could have done a little bit better, but it was what it is. The following week, as we mentioned, was the release of Color of Night. That was on August 19th. It finished fourth place in its opening weekend with $6.6 million. The other films that opened against it were Andre, which finished in 10th place, and Blank Man, which finished in 11th place. The number one film at the box office that weekend was Forrest Gump. And then the Disney films that were on the chart at the time, Lion King was in 8th place, In the Army Now was in 9th place, and Angels in the Outfield was 14th place. And in second week, Color of Night drops to 6th place behind two new releases, Corinna Corinna and Natural Born Killers. And then over Labor Day weekend, in its third week, it plummets all the way down to 13th place, then drops off the charts after 3 weeks. It only grosses $19.7 million in its theatrical run, but the budget was $40 million. Yeah. I think if you look a little closer, there were some other thrillers on the charts at the time, like Clear and Present Danger, Natural Born Killers, and The Client. But, you know, you also had movies like True Lies and Forrest Gump that were pulling in adult viewers. And I really don't think the word of mouth helped this film at all. And I looked a little closer, Chad, and, you know, for being a huge movie star, I think Bruce Willis had an up and down career at the box office. You know, after he did Die Hard 2 and Look Who's Talking To in 1990, he had this really awful streak of bombs. It was like Bonfire of the Vanities and Mortal Thoughts, Hudson Hawk, awesome movie still. And Billy Bathgate. And none of those four movies made more than $20 million. He recovered with The Last Boy Scout, which made $59 million, and Death Becomes Her, which made $58 million. But his most recent film before this was Striking Distance, and that had underperformed with only $24 million. And I mentioned it earlier when we discussed it. Chad, are we ready for Bruce Willis in an erotic psychological thriller? Because it didn't look like audiences were.
Well, and, you know, I go back kind of to a previous discussion that we were having here. The cast, although great talent and character actors that you and I are fans of, not really a lot of star power in the supporting cast. So it's basically Bruce Willis is carrying the weight of this film on his back. And even, you know, Jane March, who I think she'd only done The Lover, which was not a, you know, wide appealing film either. So I think maybe, you know, like you said, with In the Army Now, maybe a few other casting choices, bring in someone that is more well known, might have helped. But I don't know. I mean, like I said, it's not great, but I'm surprised it did as bad as it did, or as badly as it did.
Well, I mean, I wonder, this must have been tricky for the marketing folks, because is there a good time of year to release a movie like this? Like, do we want this in the summer? Should it have been in the spring? Or would it have been in the January dumping ground? Would it have been in the fall? Like, I mean, because Basic Instinct was a summer movie, if I remember correctly, because I saw it in the theater after the school year was just letting out. So maybe they were trying to sort of ride the coattails of that film. And yeah, not as much success. Okay, as we mentioned, we roll on to, again, I'll say it again, my 18th birthday, we get two movies. The first one was from Hollywood Pictures, and that's Camp Nowhere. That movie, it finished ninth place in its opening weekend with $2.8 million. The other films that opened against it were Natural Born Killers, which was finished in first place, and Wagons East, again, with the late John Candy, that finished in 14th place. The other Disney films on the charts were The Color of Night was in sixth place, Lion King was in eighth place, In the Army Now was in 12th place, and in charting during its 1 week of release, It's Pat was in 20th place. In its second week, Camp Nowhere falls all the way down to 12th place. That was the Labor Day weekend. And then it drops off the box office charts after just 2 weeks. It only grosses $10.5 million in its entire run. That's just really disappointing. I'm sorry to see that. And the only thing I could think of, was it a marketing misfire? Because like we were talking about it, I feel like junior high audiences might have been a very niche crowd. You know, they're not old enough to drive to the theater, and they probably don't want to watch movies with their parents. And as a result, I'm guessing that a lot of the older teens probably thought this movie was for younger audiences, and then the younger kids couldn't quite relate, right? And that's the only thing I could think of off the bat.
Well, and I wonder, with such a late August release date, how many schools were starting back up around this time?
Oh yeah.
You know, should this movie have come out like anywhere from mid-July through early August? You know,
well, maybe they thought that was going to work in their favor, where kids would be talking about it in school. I guess.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, because I always joke when I went to film school, I want to make a movie that a guy in school would want to ask a girl out on a date and say, "Let's go see the new Mike DeKalb movie." Just a thought. And yeah, and then I guess this movie doesn't really strike me as being a family film. You know, unless parents want to go see Doc Brown. You know, when you look at sort of the other family films that were on the charts, you know, The Lion King and The Flintstones had both been out for a while, even though they've both done very well. You know, The Little Rascals and Andre were probably more for younger audiences. So I feel like Disney timed this right. Like I said, unless you think it was kids were in school, because I think that might have worked in its favor. And just for whatever reason, just audiences did not go see it. Yeah. And then speaking of something that audiences didn't go see, again, released on that same day, August 26th, It's Pat the Movie. It only played on 33 screens in 3 cities, yet it still managed to finish in 20th place with $31,000.
I just wish, Mike, that you knew which 3 cities were terrorized by the release of It's Pat.
Yeah, and I wonder, did anyone actually duck in and say, "Oh my God, we have to go see this. I love that character from Saturday Night Live." Yeah. It drops off the box office after just the 1 week. Chad, it only grosses $60,822 in its entire theatrical run. The budget was $8 million, so not a good gamble for Disney in that regards. If you want to analyze the box office, Chad, what is there to analyze? It's an awful movie. Like, Disney knew it, and that's why it only got released on 33 screens, and audiences weren't fooled. You know, I don't feel like there was a target audience. There was no sort of counter-programming angle that we always try to talk about on this show. It just got dumped into theaters right before Labor Day on the same day as another Disney film. You know, this may have been perfect for like a January release, but I feel like Touchstone already dropped a dud in January of 1994, thanks to Chris Elliott and Cabin Boy. And they're already going to have another underperforming film ready for January 1995 that we had to look forward to. So this was, they were just doomed regardless.
Maybe they were just hoping, get it out in the theaters and then get it on home video just in time for Christmas.
You know, I was reading something about it. I read a blog about this movie and someone said, why didn't this just go straight to video? I wonder if it might have had a better chance that way. Then again, maybe not, because there is no plot, like we already said. As I like to do on this show, we look at awards consideration. As you might imagine, there is one particular award ceremony that seemed to take delight in the movies that Disney released in the summer, and at least in August of 1994. The Color of Night, this one fascinated me. The Color of Night got nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Original Song. The song was called The Color of the Night by Lauren Christie. Now, they lose to Elton John's Can You Feel the Love Tonight from The Lion King. More obvious, the film received 9 Razzie nominations. There were only 11 categories in 1995. Interestingly enough, it got nominated for the worst original song for The Color of the Night. I don't get that. It got a Golden Globe nomination and yet a Razzie nomination. Among its 9 Razzie nominations, it won Worst Picture and also got nominations for Worst Actress, Worst Actor, Supporting Actress, Worst Director, Worst Screenplay, and it got a Razzie nomination for Worst Screen Couple. But they didn't pick the couple. They just said, choose any combination of 2 people in this film and put a couple together. I did read that this is the only film to date to ever win the Worst Picture at the Golden Raspberry Awards, and yet not win any other Razzies. It just only won Worst Picture. Yeah. Speaking of Razzie nominations, It's Pat received 5 Razzie nominations. This is what I don't understand, Chad. I went way too far down a rabbit hole and could not get a clear understanding. I know the Razzies are going under a lot of scrutiny, and they do kind of annoy me sometimes. But if I ever met the people that put it together, I would ask them, why The Color of Night and It's Pat the Movie, which came out 1 week apart, were nominated for Razzie Awards in two completely different years. The Color of Night was nominated in the 1995 Razzies. It's Pat the Movie was nominated in the 1996 Razzies.
I'm going to say because no one saw It's Pat until the following year, and then they decided that it was so bad they had to nominate it.
Retroactively bring it about, I guess, yeah. It got nominated for Worst Picture, Worst Actress, Worst Screen Couple, Worst Screenplay, and Worst New Star. Lost every single award to Showgirls, which, again, we were just talking about Joe Esterhaus a minute ago, weren't we?
Yeah. So maybe he wouldn't have been good to bring in for A Color of Night.
would have just got some more Razzies for them, yeah. All right, well, as we recap the films we saw on this episode, we always like to ask, would they fit Jeffrey Katzenberg's Disney idea of singles and doubles? And you know, Chad, I feel like on the surface, it seems like these films were all bad ideas, but I give Disney credit for trying to cover all their bases and releasing them together, like a kind of like a divide and conquer strategy. It just didn't work, presumably because the films weren't good enough, right?
Well, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, because I think, with the exception of It's Pat, I think the other ones might have done well. Or, you know, the pitch sessions probably went well. You're pitching Pauly Shore, who's coming off of, Son-in-Law. And you're like, it's Pauly Shore meets Stripes. And Stripes was a huge hit. So thinking lightning can strike twice. The adult psychological thrillers were really popular at this time. Bruce Willis is a popular actor-ish, kind of, at this time. So you're like, this will work. And then Camp Nowhere is just your family kid movie. So I think I could see why these movies were greenlit, but again, it all comes down to the final product, which in two of the three cases just wasn't very good.
Yeah, and I think maybe if they had been done released at different times, maybe August just wasn't the spot for them. And I know I feel like August is still part of the summer, but for whatever reason, it's not like necessarily the best time. It's bizarre. Like, there's that big rush through Memorial Day up to July 4th and stuff. And then by the time August is rolling around, people are getting ready to get back to school or something, I guess, you know. And like you mentioned, like, I can't really begrudge them for trying to, you know, show Bruce Willis could do something other than action or comedy. Make a movie aimed towards junior high schoolers. Make a movie about a Saturday Night Live sketch after the success of Wayne's World, you know. And then they also, like you said, they had a nice relationship going with Pauly Shore, you know. The only thing that I really would give Disney a demerit for is the fact that they thought It's Pat would translate to the big screen. And maybe they should have just let 20th Century Fox go on with it.
What if you combine all four movies into one film and then release that?
Oh my God. That will challenge our viewers.
I mean, 1994 was, you know, the time of the don't ask, don't tell policy in the army. So.
God. Yes. Maybe. And then there's somehow they created their own army camp.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sex happening with murders and Andy Dick, which I got a feeling there's always a lot of sex and murder happening around Andy Dick. So,
we cut out the personal connections on this, but I have worked with Andy Dick. And I think he got arrested a week after we finished shooting. So,
oh, my God, I've had friends had encounters with Andy Dick, but I have not. Well, if any of our listeners made it to this end of the episode, and they'd like to know where to watch the films, as we mentioned, It's Pat, In the Army Now, and Color of Night are all streaming on Hoopla, the streaming service from the public library. And Camp Nowhere, go see it. It's streaming on Disney Plus, not a sponsor. Well, what are we going to look at on our next episode? We have a modern adaptation of a work of classic literature that features a popular comedic star. What film is it? Well, I guess you're just going to have to tune in to find out. This is Out of Touchstone. My name is Mike DeKalb. You can find me on Twitter at Mike DeKalb. I also run the Out of Touchstone Twitter account, which is at Out of Touchstone. You can find me on Instagram, same as well, at Out of Touchstone. Shoot me an email, outoftouchstone@gmail.com. You know, I feel like I've never done this in the course of 50-some-odd episodes of the show, but why don't you leave us a review? Isn't that I feel like every podcast I listen to, they always say rate and review and subscribe. And this is how we get
hit that like button.
Hit the like button. I don't feel like I need to grovel for this. People will subscribe if they like, but you know, we've only got a couple reviews in the span of a few years. It'd be nice if someone had a few nice things to say about the podcast. If you want to talk to Chad, he's on Twitter. He loves to talk to you at Chad Smart. Chad, again, we're calling it the August of Doom. But at least we got Camp Nowhere out of it. Do we have any final thoughts from this week?
Well, if it's an August of Doom, at least our hearts didn't get ripped out and sacrificed to a Indian god. So, time for love, Mr. DeKalb.
Oh, man. Watching Its Pat felt like I was going in the Temple of Doom, that's for sure. This is Out of Touchstone, and we are thankfully out of time. You're out of touch. I'm
out of time. Out of Touchstone is a Honey Nerds production. For more information, go to outoftouchstone.com. Be sure to follow at Out of Touchstone on Instagram and Twitter. And also, please like, subscribe, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for listening.
So, you're cool, I'm cool, we're cool. Thank you. Good night.
A popular sketch character from Saturday... Wow, it's been a while. Loosen up the tongue. Blah, 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 blah. There's your ending blooper.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Oh, I crushed my nuts!